trusts, working to protect America's public lands for future generations to enjoy at pewtrusts.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Linguist Deborah Tannen is interested. One of her most recent projects explored conversation between sisters. This afternoon, we'll talk with Tannen, who has two sisters, about what she learned. It's the subject of her new book, You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. Tannen writes that sisters share in conversation, we share in all relationships, only more so. Deborah Tannen is a linguist at Georgetown. You're Wearing That, Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation, and I only say this because I love you, talking to your parents, partner, sibs, and kids when you're all adults. Deborah Tannen's new book, You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives, is published by Random House. Deborah Tannen, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
Well, in the course of the project, did you interview any sister, any woman with a sister or sisters who was blasé about the relationship? This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our apologies. We have a technical problem there with that recording from the archives, so we're going to try another one. This is an interview from the archives with Tony Horwitz. Stay tuned. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program today, what you may or may not know about the founding of America by Europeans. 1492 and Christopher Columbus, James Smith, 1607 and the founding of Jamestown, the Mayflower and Plymouth Rock, 1620. These may leap immediately to mind, but if you were to sit down and try to write a few paragraphs about the European discovery and settlement of America, many of us would find the assignment frustrating. How quickly would we turn to Google and Wiki? Something like this happened to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tony Horwitz. and it set him on course to research and write his new book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. Let me share with you a couple of the things that I learned from A Voyage Long and Strange. Did you know John Smith was a braggart, a con man, an escape artist, and an accomplished killer? That's how Horowitz describes him. He also says Smith was an exemplar of the American dream. Did you know English Massachusetts had first been settled because of syphilis? Horowitz says one Bartholomew Gosnold set sail for New England in 1602 looking for sassafras to be used as a cure. I had no idea. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Tony Horowitz is the author of Blue Latitudes, Confederates in the Attic, and Baghdad Without a Map. His new book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World, is published by Henry Holt. There's more about our guest and his new book at the website, www.voyagelongandstrange.com. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Tony Horowitz, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me again.
My pleasure. Well, tell us how it was that you found yourself thinking about the early arrival of Europeans in the Americas.
Yeah, a few summers ago, I was on a road trip through New England and pulled off to see Plymouth Rock, where I'd never visited, this great icon of American history. The first thing that struck me is how physically unimpressive it is. It's basically just a cracked little boulder sitting in a dirty sand pit. But what really startled me was a conversation I had with a ranger there who said that visitors are very confused by the date etched on the rock, which says 1620, when the Mayflower landed. And they often ask, why doesn't it say 1492? Isn't that when Columbus arrived?
Ouch.
And as she explained it, a lot of visitors think Columbus sailed here, dropped off the pilgrims, and sailed home, that they know Columbus and the pilgrims, and everything else is kind of a blank. And at first this amused me, but then as I drove off, I started scanning my own brain for what I knew about the European founding and discovery of America beyond Columbus and the pilgrims, and I realized almost nothing. So that really set me off on this voyage to fill in that gaping hole in my knowledge.
Yeah, I know that on your website you have a quiz that we can take. I haven't had the courage to go there yet.
Right. Well, you'll be happy to know I did some of the research for this book during a fellowship at Harvard, and I gave a talk about my book in progress, and I gave a pop quiz to this room full of professors. And I'm sort of perversely gratified to report that they flunked. So I think it's fair to say even overeducated Americans are pretty clueless about this era.
Yeah. Well, you started your research by reading, and then you decided you'd do more. You'd look for history on the ground. So you decided that you'd hit the road. Where did your travels take you?
I really tried to follow this chronologically. And to tell the full story of the European discovery of America, you have to begin 1,000 years ago with the Vikings, who were the first known European visitors to North America. So I began my own voyage by going to the northern tip of Newfoundland, which is the site of the only confirmed Viking settlement that's been found in North America. It's a very bleak place. Even in summer, there are icebergs. It helped me understand a bit why the Vikings didn't stick around. I went from there down to the Caribbean to tell the story of Columbus, who, by the way, never reached what is now the U.S., then to Mexico and up into today's United States and really all across the country on the trail of these various explorers.
And what did this approach lend to your research?
A couple things. One, I think it deepens your understanding of past events to go to the places where history happens. to see what they look like, to see what the explorers were describing, to get a sense of the landscape and the climate. Also, at times, you can see archaeological remains, which I think, again, add to your understanding. But also, I like to, I'm interested in the present as well and how the past bleeds into the present. So going to these places helps me understand the legacy of these long-ago events and how they're remembered today.
Yeah, it's also interesting to learn what people living in these places today think and feel about the history of that place.
Yeah, and there definitely tend to be regional differences, as you might guess. I've recently moved from Virginia to Massachusetts, and in Virginia, people are very aware and proud of Jamestown being the first permanent English settlement on this continent. In Massachusetts, they really disregard everything before Plymouth, even though Plymouth was quite late in the story of European settlement. And then, for instance, in the Southwest, people are obviously more aware of the Spanish history there that precedes the English. And I don't know, in Illinois, or at least maybe in northern Illinois, there might be some consciousness of the role of the French, who were, significant in the Great Lakes area and also in northern New England.
Yeah, they were also significant in the, I want to say the southwestern part of Illinois, along the Mississippi.
Right. Well, I restricted myself ended my book really in 1620 because I didn't want this to be a multi-volume work. So I didn't get into that, which I think is a slightly later period.
Yeah. Well, fairly early in the book, we can come back maybe to the Vikings because it is interesting that we think of them as being very hardy and big, tough guys.
Right.
And they couldn't take it.
Right. Well, it wasn't so much that they couldn't take it. They were indeed very hardy folk, and the places they came from were just as forbidding as northern Newfoundland. What they couldn't do was do what they had done in Europe, which was subdue their foes. They were, we think of them as mighty warriors, but they were no match for the Native Americans they encountered, who were well-armed with bows and arrows and catapults. They outnumbered the Vikings. They attacked them in fleets of canoes, and basically the Vikings, who came in very small numbers, realized, they couldn't stay. So, and they left. And then really in the first recorded contest between Europeans and natives, the home team won.
Yeah. How do we know about the Vikings in Greenland, in Labrador, in Newfoundland?
Right. Well, it's interesting because our primary source are the sagas, the great Icelandic sagas that were originally stories told 1,000 years ago. They were later written down by medieval clerics and have sort of filtered down to us that way. They were long viewed as very unreliable as historical sources because they tell these quite fantastic and supernatural stories. But it was actually a Norwegian man, Helge Ingstad, in 1960, using clues in the sagas, as well as some other clues, who actually discovered this site in northern Newfoundland. So there's a strong kernel of truth to what's in the sagas, even though they are 1,000 years old and do mix, fact and fiction. In addition to that, there's been archaeological work not only in Newfoundland, but in Greenland, which was the colony from which they came, and Iceland, so that they can match what they found in these various places and understand about the material life of the Vikings and other aspects.
The Norse sagas, if they mix fact and fiction, would you say that in a sense, or really, that's what we do with our history as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Everything changes in the telling, and clearly with the sagas over the centuries, stories became embroidered or mixed up. I think, our history isn't that ancient. I think instead what we've done is created a series of myths and then clung to them, really, despite a lot of evidence to the contrary. So this sort of myth of pilgrims, settling a virgin wilderness, this sort of untouched land, and really beginning the American story, you know, is with us forever, probably, and it's a wonderful story. It's just that there are a lot of other stories that should also be included.
Yeah. Well, tell us the story or the non-story of John Smith and Pocahontas.
Yeah, I mean, what interested me about doing this book was not only were there dozens of expeditions and characters and Spanish, French, Portuguese, etc., that I knew nothing about, though even the ones that we think we know about, we really don't. Most of what we know is myth and misconception, and John Smith and Pocahontas are probably exhibit A for that. If Americans know anything about them, it's that they had a love affair. Well, I'm sorry to report there's no evidence of that. Pocahontas was only about 10 when John Smith met her, and he was gone not long thereafter. He wasn't in Virginia all that long, and she goes on to marry a different John, John Rolfe, who's really unfairly forgotten because he's also a very significant figure in the early history of Virginia. I should add that Pocahontas dies of disease on a visit to England at about the age of 19 or 20. So really, her story overall is more tragic than romantic. It really doesn't match the Disney version, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and why should we remember John Rolfe?
For one, his marriage to Pocahontas was something that hadn't happened before, an English person marrying an Indian and also the daughter of the powerful Chief Powhatan. So it brought about a period of peace in Virginia that allowed the colony to grow. But more importantly, he was the first to really successfully grow tobacco in a colony in North America. He brought some seeds and experimented with different strains of tobacco. And within a few years, this became a fantastic cash crop, and it really saved Jamestown from ruin. It had done very poorly up to that point, but tobacco became a craze.
Okay, well, now tobacco gets us to Columbus.
Yeah, well, again, Columbus is one of these figures that, you know, perhaps makes us yawn. We learned a little bit about him in school. He's not only nothing like the storybook version, he's much more interesting. He's really, I guess I was taught, you know, that he was this sort of far-sighted modern, this visionary who knew the world was round when everyone else thought it was flat. Well, for starters, that wasn't an unusual opinion. Most people thought the world was round then. And in fact, he later recanted of that view and decided the world was shaped more like a pear, with the stem he likened to a woman's nipple, and imagined the Garden of Eden at the top of it. So he really was more of a medieval mystic who was sort of chasing a globe of his own imagining, and really up to his death still thought he had found the Indies, despite four voyages to America that showed this couldn't possibly be so.
Yeah, and you say he commands more print than almost any man in history, yet he remains elusive. He, you say, invited this mystery. How and why?
He was a very elusive fellow. He came from a very modest family in Italy, and he was a man of his day. This was a feudal time where status and titles meant everything. So he concealed his modest origins. He, you know, really masked himself in all kinds of ways. He signed his name in a way that's yet to be conclusively deciphered. Again, he was this quite mystical character. We don't know where exactly in America he landed on Columbus Day in 1492, somewhere in the Bahamas. We don't know to this day exactly where his bones are. And part of my book is a sort of goose chase to the Dominican Republic to see his alleged bones unveiled. So despite everything that's been written about Columbus, we really there are many important things we don't know about him.
Yeah. Is his description of tobacco the first we have?
The first by a European, yes. He arrives in the Bahamas and sails on to Cuba and the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And he sees now natives are offering Columbus and his men this sort of strange weed that they obviously value very highly. And then he realizes when he sees them smoking it, you know, what it's for. It seems that the word tobacco, which was a native word, actually referred to not to the weed itself, but to these kind of giant cigars that they smoked it in. And so that's really the first record we have of tobacco.